Hello and welcome to News 24 on Air, our live audio service. I'm Mihlali Ntsabo. So last year, liquidator Glutamari and his son and business partner Thomas were gunned down on the N1 North in Johannesburg. The two were murdered just as they had started to unearth evidence that siblings Rishul and Nishani Singh, with whom they spent their final hours, had built a billion rand empire in a series of lies and bribes. News 24 investigation spanning more than a year has revealed an expansive web of corruption spun by the Singhs in Ghana, where they secured a handful of road and hospital construction contracts worth at least 1 billion rand and maintained favour by paying at least 50 million rand in bribes to influential politicians in the country. Carl Cowan, senior investigative and data journalist at News 24, joins us now in studio to tell us more about his findings. Carl, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Right, let's start off with who the Singhs are and how they got to make their money in South Africa.
So, Rishul and Nishani are brother and sister, obviously. They started a company. Well, they took over an auditing firm that they then named Big Business Innovations Group. It was a spin-off from the old SABNT, Nexia, a well-known auditing firm from way back when. And this company has sort of done extensive work for government entities. You know, I'm thinking off the top of my head, the Auditor General of South Africa, Department of Mineral Resources and Energy, the Johannesburg Roads Agency, the National Department of Health, National Health Laboratory Service. So they would be appointed to panels and they would do internal audit work for these entities. And by all accounts, the business was doing relatively well. You know, as far as I can see, at the time that the company was liquidated in November 2022, they had contracts worth roughly 45 million rand on their books still at that point, and bearing in mind that they had obviously completed many contracts over several years. So Rishul is or was a chartered accountant. He is no longer allowed to use that title because SAICA has kicked him out. Nishani, to my understanding, is not a CA, but she does have an MBA degree, business management degree. And they sort of built up this audit firm from a spin-off from an old and audit firm, and they built it into something quite respectable, quite big. They were certainly not short of money, is my understanding. And then in 2015, they started expanding into Ghana. And the first project was to install a 20-megawatt solar project, you know, and that sort of never got off the ground. It sort of failed for reasons that I can't really figure out 100%, but it looks to do with the financing sort of never came through. But in that process of putting together that contract, they obviously met some people in Ghana, and then that's how they would later, you know, sort of build up this quite extensive list of contracts. So, I mean, based on what we've been able to find out, they've between 2017 and 2022, their Ghanaian company was paid the equivalent of 340 million by the Ghanaian government. And their story of wealth, however, is really more linked to loans that they got from Investec Bank.
Right.
And between 2016 to 2021, we're talking about more than half a billion rand in loans.
Yeah.
Some of those for the companies, some of those for houses that they bought, some of those for cars.
Personal use, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. And that's really where we start to see, you know, Rishul especially posting on social media, being tagged by social media influencers, driving these really nice cars, you know, McLaren P1, McLaren Senna. And, you know, there's this wonderful tweet from, I think it's around 2020, where someone asks, you know, what does this guy do for a living?
Yeah.
How can a chartered accountant afford all these really, really nice cars?
Very expensive cars.
And that was, that like always has always stood out to me a little bit, just that, that one question, and I set about trying to dig into that. So that's how we sort of know, you know, we have a rough idea of how they made their money. Other than that, you know, as far as their personal history goes, it's been quite difficult to find people who are willing to talk about them, you know, about where they're from, how they grew up, anything like that. But the only thing I can say is that I know that the brother and sister, they're extremely close. And what one person said to me is that you rarely see one without the other. So that sort of gives you an indication that, you know, they did sort of everything together. And that really shines through in terms of looking at the business side of things, how things were done. you know, they're always together, they're always there.
Yeah, even a simple Google search shows that they're quite an elusive, discreet family. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that, you know, we first see their footprint in Ghana in 2015. I'm just curious to find out, was there any particular reason why they...
Not that I can find out. You know, unfortunately, neither Rashil or Nishani have ever spoken to me. Mm-hmm. You know, and we've tried. I've also tried through intermediaries who, you know, it's sort of, they sort of just don't want to talk. And I think it has a lot to do with the, you know, the numerous legal processes that are going on. I think they would be worried about saying things that could potentially get them in trouble. But,
yeah,
you know, from my understanding is, I think the solar opportunity sort of presented itself through some other conversation that they had with someone, and that was sort of their entry point. And how that happened, I'm not entirely sure, but I'm hoping that one day we can sort of, you know, dig in a little bit and figure all of that out. Because Ghana is not... It's not exactly a natural choice for this, for a South African company to expand
100%
into.
100%, yeah. So, Kyle, let's now revisit that fateful Saturday where the Murrays were shot in their car. So we know that, you know, in their final hours, they actually had a meeting with the Singhs. Mm. And we're assuming at this point it was them basically talking about their findings regarding this.
Yeah, so what happened was in November of 2022, Investec launches court proceedings to start liquidating the South African company.
Okay.
And the reason for that is just very simple. It's quite easy to explain. BIG and the Ghanaian company, which they call JIC or JIC, they had loaned all this money from Investec, and there were payments due, you know, at certain times, you know, every 3 months or every month or whatever. And sort of early in 2022, the Singhs started discussion with the bank to say, listen, you know, we would like to look at restructuring all of this debt so that we can pay it in a different way or whatever. At the end of August 2022, 130 or 140 million rand payment was due, and that payment was missed. Another payment was missed. And then the bank started moving quite quickly at that stage because, you know, they were exposed in such a massive way that they sort of had to move relatively quickly. And that set in motion a whole series of events that leads up to not just the day that the Murrays were shot, but the day before, actually, which is also just as important. Mm-hmm. And so just a quick summary. What happens is Investec starts court proceedings in November. Mm. By middle November, they discover that a 150 million rand bank guarantee allegedly issued by Stanbic Bank in Ghana to secure a 150 million rand loan is forged. It's a fake. Mm. And the bank obviously then ratchets up its court proceedings, makes them urgent, file supplementary affidavits. The company is then provisionally liquidated towards the BIG, is provisionally liquidated towards the end of November. By early December, Clute Murray is appointed by the Master of the High Court. Now, you know, we always just talk about Clute's appointment. There were other liquidators also appointed together with him. Mm-hmm. But, you know, none of their actions sort of influenced any of this. Clute was the guy who was running with everything. So we focus on him. And by the 9th of December 2022, Clute was then, you know, sort of saying he's going to convene a confidential inquiry, which in terms of the Companies Act, these inquiries are either under Section 417 or 418 of the Companies Act. They are, I think, the most valuable tool that a liquidator has, because in effect what happens is, excuse me, a retired judge is appointed to oversee the process. Mm. You know, both sides have lawyers. They have an evidence leader. They have someone who does questioning. And the whole process is confidential. So nothing you say in those proceedings can be used against you later by the National Prosecuting Authority or the police or whatever. Mm. The sole purpose of these inquiries is to try and understand why the company has failed. Well, you know, who's responsible? Mm. Who's at fault? And very often with companies where a lot of corruption has taken place or whatever, these hearings can be quite, the word I want to use is vigorous, but to give you an idea, you know, there are situations where people have been questioned in front of these 417 inquiries and then have, you know, actually sadly committed suicide like a day or two later because of how strenuous it is. It's really quite, you know, it's quite serious. And so the the liquidation inquiry into Big like sort of gets off the ground early in January of 2023, and very quickly, you know, it's sort of, because these things are confidential, you know, we can't say too much about what happens in them, but to my mind, it's very clear that very quickly some evidence started coming out, sort of okay. confirming the bank's suspicions and so on. And then that leads up to the 17th of March, the day before Clute and Thomas were shot. They make an appointment with Rashil and Nishani because another company of theirs has now also been liquidated, i2 Infinite Innovations. Now, this company is the owner of three properties, an apartment in Brooklyn in Pretoria, a house in Lawley Street in Waterkloof in Pretoria, and an apartment in Melrose Arch. And all of these properties were bought with bonds from Investec. And because they had defaulted and stopped paying the other loans, there are provisions in all of these big loan agreements where if I have five loans from the bank and I miss a payment on one and then I sort of get involved in legal processes, a cross default is triggered. So then the bank can effectively come and say, you must pay us everything owed for every single one of these loans.
Okay.
And that's what happened. So i2 Infinite Innovations, a company of which Rashil Singh is a director, holding it's holding all of these properties and these bonds. Investec liquidates that company too. And Thomas Murray is then appointed on the 14th of March as provisional liquidator on that company. And the reason why that is done, and you know, a lot of people have sort of always looked at it funny and said, oh, well, father and son appointed to these. But because they had already started working on the liquidation of that company, the master of the High Court looks at it and says, okay, but these are two obviously interrelated companies. So let's appoint Thomas here and his father there. That way they can work together, get it done. And the 17th, the Friday, was the third time the confidential inquiry into Big's affairs sat, and Thomas made an appointment with Rashil Singh that day to meet with him at the properties the next day. And the purpose of that meeting was very simple. i2 had not been finally liquidated yet. It still hasn't. Those court proceedings are still ongoing. But as a liquidator, one of the main things you have to do is preserve assets so that they can't be sold or, you know, whatever. So they went there, they would change the locks, for example, so that the owner can't access the building without permission or whatever. And they visited those three properties, didn't spend much time at them. Sort of security is placed at the house in Waterkloof, they check out. And then they parted ways around about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Just before 1 o'clock, Clute and his son Thomas and then two auctioneers who were with them that day, they went and had coffee at a restaurant at Melrose Arch. And, you know, it's sort of, it was sort of nothing out of the ordinary. the work of a liquidator is to do these things. And Clute has always done it in a way that is not very, you know, there's no animosity there. He was always like very matter of fact about it. And I can speak from personal experience on this because I worked, you know, on a lot of investigations into Bosasa, of which he was the liquidator. Yes. So I sort of had run-ins with him in the beginning, you know, sort of butted heads a little bit about certain things. And then I sort of started realizing that, you know, he's actually doing a good job. So I've seen that process unfold, you know, sort of at close range. And it can be quite, it's quite difficult for the directors of those companies. It's not a fun process. And this is exactly what they would do on any other estate. So there was nothing sort of out of the ordinary about that, you know?
Yeah. Now let's look at, you know, these billion rand contracts that the Murrays were working on that were awarded to the Singhs through their company, the Ghana Investment Corporation. Do we know how many contracts there were in total? You know, how much roughly each were one of them, I guess, each costed? And also, did they successfully complete those projects?
Well, if you ask them, I'm sure they'll tell you they did, to your last point. I mean, it's quite difficult because it's, you know, like any government anywhere, it's not exactly easy to get information about contracts awarded and values and sort of those things paid out. But, you know, what I have figured out is we're talking about, I would say, between 5 and 10 contracts in total. Of which a handful are subcontracts on hospital construction. The others are most of their work came from entities owned or administered by the Ghanaian Roads Department, so the equivalent of our Department of Transport.
Okay.
And so the Ghanaian entities, they have a Ghanaian Ministry of Roads and Highways, I believe it's called, and then underneath that they have the Ghanaian Road Fund, they have the Department of Urban Roads, and then they have the Department of Feeder Roads. So they have like various little departments that all technically do the same job as our Department of Transport in terms of road construction, etc.
Okay.
The value of those contracts was enormously difficult to sort of figure out. You know, during the course of the investigation, we got access to quite a lot of documentation. I was able to look at some annual financial statements for the company, try and figure out, and I realized very quickly, you know, not being a chartered accountant by any stretch of the imagination, but I realized quite quickly that I can't really figure out what these financial statements are saying.
Okay.
Because you'll find one set of financials that says the contracts are worth this amount and another worth that. And what I then eventually figured out is that it looks like they had inflated the value of the contracts in their financial statements quite significantly.
Okay.
So I drilled it down to call it just over R1 billion equivalent value.
Okay.
And those are for contracts awarded between 2017 and 2021.
Mm-hmm.
Whether the work has actually physically been completed, you know, I've spoken to several people, and there seems to be a consensus that some work was actually done.
Okay.
But, you know, the scale of it, the location of it has been very difficult to determine. You know, it's sort of, the contracts are, you know, they sort of give a description of what roads are going to be rehabilitated and, you know, from where they run to where they run. But it does, you can't like forensically pinpoint it and say, okay, this work was definitely done without, I think, going to Ghana and spending 6 or 7 months there, which, you know, is not always possible.
Mm.
But I think there is a relative degree of confidence that some work was done because Investec wouldn't have continued funding unless they could have seen some physical construction on the ground.
Right. Now, let's come to those Investec loans, right? Of course, earlier you mentioned that they actually used these contracts to secure these loans. And then you also established that, you know, some of the money was used for, I guess, the work, but also most of it went to personal leisure. And we talk about some of the cars that they purchased. What else did they actually use that money for?
Well, everything under the sun you can think of. I mean, imagine you getting access to a massive pot of money pretty much immediately with very little oversight.
Yeah.
And also because of the way that the money was sort of moved from their company to personal accounts in Ghana, there's this thing in the back of my mind when I'm looking at all of this and then I'm thinking to myself, you know, this looks a lot like tax evasion. I'm not a tax expert. I'm not a tax lawyer. I don't work for SARS, but it sort of seems to me that if let's take, for example, the one car that was purchased, it's a 2014 McLaren P1, one of 375 ever made, you know, sort of, at the time when that car came out, it was sort of the pinnacle of what cars could do. It's part of one of the it's known as, you know, if you follow Top Gear and Jeremy Clarkson and these guys or whatever, it's one of the cars known as the Holy Trinity. You know, you have the McLaren P1, you have the Porsche 918 Spyder, and then there's the Ferrari, La Ferrari, which these cars are all hybrid, you know, sort of very pioneering technology at that time. So he purchases this car for $1.5 million, and the money flow is quite interesting. So in April of 2019, Investec grants a $17.5 million loan to JIC for work in Ghana. Mm. And how this loan is secured is obviously, you know, they have contracts with the Ghanaian government and they're able to show Investec, this is how much work we've completed, this is how much work we're still, you know, this is how much we've done, which we are still owed for.
Mm.
And here's a letter from the Ghanaian government saying, you know, they owe us X amount. And then the money is transferred from Investec on the 9th of May to the company's dollar account in Ghana.
Okay.
The money reflects the next day on the 10th.
Mm.
And very early that morning, the money is moved to Rashil Singh's private dollar account. And then a couple of hours later, the payment is made to McLaren in Philadelphia in the U.S., But now, interestingly, in Philadelphia, you have a sales tax on all goods, so a 6% sales tax. So he would have been liable for, well, let me do some quick maths here, 10% of 1.5 is, you know, 150. So call it $100,000, you know, about R1 million in sales tax. So instead, what these wealthy car buyers do in America especially, they register a company in Montana, which is sort of a tax haven. Having a company registered there means you have a registered address, and then you register the car in the name of that company, and then you avoid the sales tax.
Okay.
You know, so these are the kind of things that they did. You know, I mean, for example, the McLaren Senna, which is the successor to the McLaren P1. It is bought directly from McLaren, brand new. McLaren's factory is in Woking in the UK. And the car is registered in the name of a company, Business Innovations, that is registered in London. It is brought to South Africa on a trade exemption. So basically, you're allowed to bring the car here to exhibit it or to take it to a show or whatever. Technically, you're not allowed to drive the car anywhere, you know. And then the car has to go back within a certain time frame. You can obviously extend it or whatever. But by doing it that way, you avoid paying import duty and tax on the vehicle. And I think, you know, just, and this is my opinion, I think if the South African Revenue Service was interested in, you know, doing their jobs, they should probably go and check out the fact that these cars were actually then brought in for personal use under this exemption.
Yes.
And then there's a tax liability attached to that. But I think it speaks to the bigger sort of attitude of how and why these cars were bought and what they were used for. I mean, the story that we published on News24 yesterday is that they spent 120 million rand on cars. Now, now, to give you an idea, between May 2022 and November 2022, when everything with the Investec loans was sort of starting to crash down, the Ghanaian government paid JIC in Ghana 62 million rand, the equivalent of 62 million, which means they could have made the payments on the loans. But they didn't. And, you know, it's one of the key questions that I asked them. It's like, sort of, why didn't you consider selling some of these assets? Why didn't you do this? And it's so frustrating, actually, I think, in a way, that they just have refused to respond to that and explain that. Or to come forward and say, no, but this is what you don't understand about this. You know, our cash flow, this was our situation, X, Y, Z. So now we sort of left to guess and look at it from, like, you know, a one point of view kind of thing. But I think it's pretty obvious that a big reason for why the South African company failed was this extravagant expenditure. Because the cars are one thing, but then there's traveling, there's clothing, there's all these sort of things that are very difficult to track years after the fact.
Yeah.
That's why we focus in on the cars.
Yeah.
Something that you can tangibly track and see where these things have gone.
Right. Kyle, I mean, it's quite obvious that they had to be working with very prominent figures in Ghana to secure these tenders.
Yeah, you know, so based on our investigations, you know, and I sort of say in my story that there are at least 94 million rand that I've identified that I think is suspect. Of that, around about 47 million rand went to or for the benefit of one person, Haruna Idrisu, who is a prominent opposition member of parliament in that
politician
country. And another was the deputy roads minister, who received the equivalent of about R1 million. I suspect there's obviously a lot more. But what happened here is that in some cases I was able to identify it because the payments were, like, quite clearly marked and it was, you know, quite obvious. But in other cases, money would be paid over to Asuma Dokarugu, who is their sort of director for JIC in Ghana, who's their sort of point person there. And the money would sort of... It would sort of be flagged as, you know, either project fees or facilitation fees. And it would then be paid over to him. And whether he would then draw that out in cash and give it to someone or pay it over to another bank account, that's something that the Ghanaian authorities are going to have to dig into, because obviously, so, you know, we are too far away to have insight into these things.
Yeah, 100%. And then, of course, the Ghanaian government has not responded.
No, Mr. Idrisu has responded. He issued a statement yesterday basically vehemently denying all our allegations, saying that we haven't offered a shred of proof and so on. You know, I think he's quite within his rights to do that. We did try, obviously, to contact him prior to publication, and he sort of ignored us. And strangely, he's now trying to claim that social media accounts linked to him are not actually linked to him, but he's quite obviously active on these accounts, so I don't know. But we are taking a look at his statement that he's issued. There are some key denials in there that I think deserve a bit of a deeper look. So I'm going to be examining that statement a little bit more before we just record it and then obviously try and engage with him and deliver a follow-up for News 24's readers.
Right. And before I let you go, Carl, let's circle back now to the Murray murder investigations. How far are we with that?
You know, that's a difficult one. You know, one of our first stories that we published this year, we said that, you know, a person of interest, Mr. Ryan Barwell, who was caught on CCTV driving a vehicle that looks to be the vehicle that was used to actually commit the murders, had not been questioned by police. When I spoke with him, he wasn't even aware that he was a person of interest in the investigation or anything like that. And, you know, it sort of has stuck there. I don't think that anyone, any member of the Murray family, I don't think, are holding their breath for any action anytime soon. But, you know, that being said, I know that there is police work ongoing. You know, I do know that they are meeting regularly with the deputy director of public prosecutions for Gauteng, who's guiding this investigation. I think we are, you know, deep into frustration territory here because of the high profile nature of this case and no movement and so on. But as far as what the actual progress is, unfortunately, you know, that's something we'll only figure out one day when there's a trial going on. We can see what they've been busy with.
100%. And one more question, Carl, before I let you go. What do you hope the reader takes away from your series?
No, we have to understand how important the recovery system, you know, people look at liquidators and they're often quite reviled. And, you know, because of the nature of their work, people would generally just hate them because, you know, there's all sorts of, and to be fair, the insolvency industry is you know, it's fraught with, you know, characters who are involved in corruption and all sorts of dodgy things, and it's a very murky sort of place to be digging around into. But it's very crucial to understand that, and someone made this point to me actually earlier today, and I thought it was quite interesting. The master's office, the master of the High Court, who administers the appointment of liquidators to estates and also administers deceased estates, every single person in South Africa will have to interact with the master's office once because we all die.
Yes, 100%.
And at that stage, you know, if the master's office is corrupt, it's going to have a knock-on effect on everything. If your system for recovery of money, look at the Gupta companies, of which Klute was a liquidator of one as well. If there isn't a sufficient, you know, active recovery mechanism in our law, if liquidators are too scared to do their jobs, if the master's office is too corrupt or too captured and you know, cannot do its job, its function properly, then the crooks are going to carry on getting away with these things. And when I say getting away with it, I mean, I'm not talking about criminal prosecutions. I mean, they get to keep the nice houses and the nice cars and everything that they bought with stolen taxpayer rands. This is what's important about this. This is why we're focusing on it. And Klute and his son Thomas were the best, I think, in my opinion, they were the best in the insolvency industry. They were fearless and they were doing the job properly, you know, by the book. That's what's important about this.
Right. Carl Cowan, senior investigative journalist at News 24. And of course, you can find Carl's series on news24.com. That's all we have for now. Until next time, I'm Ishalin Sabo.